Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. Alex J. Mengel is a name you likely aren't familiar with, but his crimes and methods of death dealing were inspiration for author Thomas Harris in his writing of The Silence of the Lambs, which you no doubt know quite well. What nobody knows is how many people, women, girls, men, Mengel poached before his shocking death in April of 1985. There's not a whole lot that I could find about Mengel. I'll share that he looked a little bit like Ricky from the Trailer Park Boys. I know he was from Guyana, and that he hung out with shady types from his homeland. His trade was as a tool and die maker, but he also worked as a security guard. I know that he often lied about being sick and collected disability checks so he could do whatever he wanted in his mysterious life that was anchored in the Bronx of New York. Mengel lost his wife and child after having become so abusive, breaking his wife's jaw actually, that his wife's name was changed, his son's name was changed, and they were relocated, leaving Mengel to live out of his car and with friends, and at times in the woods of the Catskills, practicing the skills of a cat, stalking, pouncing, then dragging his prey away to be toyed with and maimed, eventually murdered. The details are hazy, but from what we can see, it's probably better that way. Welcome to Dark Topic, I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The Poacher. February 24th, 1985, 7 p.m., Westchester County, New York. Alex J. Mengel, recently turned 30, had probably been up to no good for a while. Mengel is driving the Sawmill River Parkway in Yonkers on his way home from a hunting trip with friends in the Catskill Mountains. There's three or four other passengers with him as he speeds in his blue 1973 Mercury Capri. Mengel's vehicle is incredibly conspicuous. Ghostbusters is a popular movie at this time, and Mengel has painted a white, cartoonish ghost that looks more like Casper than anything Ghostbusters related on the trunk and the hood of his Mercury Capri. Around New York, this vehicle has become known as the Ghostbusters car or the Ghostmobile, which gives us some insight into Mengel's personality. He's a childish attention seeker and a moron of sorts. I mentioned that he'd likely been up to no good for a while, as the passenger side door of his vehicle had been tampered with so that it could only be opened from the exterior, a classic tactic used by more than one predator in the Dark Topic catalog, also one that when I think back on my own experiences in life, I now have to question why I recall being in a few vehicles with this same malfunction, and why that's all I recall. But anyways, Officer Gary Stimulowski was a young cop with a lot of experience and from a family of fellow officers. He loved the job, he was good at it, being awarded as Officer of the Year in 1984 for his performance with the Westchester County PD. He was engaged to be married and had a bright future that became instantly dim upon spotting Mengel's Ghostmobile speeding and weaving through his picturesque patrol section of the Sawmill Parkway in Yonkers. Alex Mengel pulls over soon after he and his three passengers, two young men and a young woman, all of Guyanese descent, are bathed in blue and white light. Officer Stimulowski takes note that the passengers fidget nervously as he approaches them with his flashlight. The driver is the only one who's still. Mengel stares down the cop through his side view mirror. Alex Mengel opens the driver's side door and informs Officer Stimulewski that his window isn't working. This is a more laid-back era of policing. Mengel is allowed to exit and begin loudly talking, no doubt in an attempt to charm and or intimidate the cop. Neither tactic works, probably because he has shitty cartoon ghosts crudely painted on his car. And I'm joking around, but this is a serious situation. Alex Mengel is incredibly dangerous and will prove it momentarily. But first, he's told to sit back in his seat while Officer Stimulewski runs his plates. It's at this point that Mengel shares that he has a shotgun and two long rifles in the trunk. Officer Stimulewski has Mengel show them to him. Mengel offers to pull one out to give him a closer look, but is told that won't be necessary. The trunk is then closed, and Mengel seems to have won the officer over a little bit with his honesty about the weapons. Well, they are for the purpose of hunting, actually. That's what he and his friends had been doing all weekend up in the Catskills. It's now Sunday evening, and Mengel just wants to get home, he says. He has a wife and young son. The car is actually under his wife's name. Mengel doesn't share that it's under what used to be her name, but he does know that his criminal history will likely turn up soon. He's hoping this cop will let him go before he realizes Mengel does not have a driver's license. Mengel does not want to go to jail tonight. He's got a lot of skeletons in his closet, and there's no telling which ones might fall out if he's printed and processed. Alex Mengel is told to stop talking and to find his license and registration. The cop and Mengel separate and head to their respective vehicles. There is no real obvious tension. That is until Mengel is back in the driver's seat of his Capri, his ghostmobile, telling his friends that this cop is going to call for backup and have them all arrested. And that Mengel has decided to shoot him. Mengel's friends are obviously criminals as they follow his instructions. He tells one of the young men to get in the driver's seat and to take the car back to the Bronx once he hears the shot. Mengel then grabs his unregistered .380 pistol from hiding and approaches the still flashing patrol car. The reality here is that Officer Stimulewski has no intention of arresting Mengel and his friends, by the way. Even once he radios in the Ghostmobile and finds the driver to be unlicensed, the plan is to have the vehicle impounded and Mengel heavily fined. Officer Gary Stimulewski looks up from his ticket writing and sees Alex Mengel coming. He must figure that there's going to be some negotiation attempt, which is common in these parts, and returns to his work. Again, this story takes place in a time before every cop in North America became justifiably and sometimes dangerously high-strung. This will be the last traffic stop in New York where the driver of a pulled-over vehicle will be allowed to exit and approach a patrol car. What happens to Officer Stimulewski at the hand of Alex Mengel will ruin any trust between cops and citizens at a traffic stop forever. Mengel creeps through the darkness between the two vehicles, headlights of passing cars flashing upon him, trees in the background. It is a nice area. It's a little highway that kind of goes through Yonkers, and there's trees on either side from what is my understanding. It's fairly peaceful out here, but it's about to become completely opposite. Mengel comes up to Officer Stimulewski's window. Stimulewski acts cool. Mengel puts his gun to the head of the ticket-writing cop and fires. It's a contact execution, they say. He put the gun right up to his head, touched it to it, and fired. Officer Stimulewski slumps to the passenger side. This guy's in his mid-20s. You know, his whole life ahead of him. And now there's blood spurting from a smoking bullet hole in his head. Mengel gets into the patrol car and shoves the dying cop over. Ahead, his beloved Ghostmobile peels out as instructed. Mengel follows suit. Lights still flashing on the cop car he's now commandeered. He struggles to find a switch to turn those lights off, but he can't figure it out. On the radio, he soon hears other cops questioning if Sam 1 is engaged in a chase. That's the call sign for this patrol car, Sam 1. Soon there are requests for Officer Stimulewski to respond. And obviously he cannot. He's dying here. He's about dead by this point, as Mengel flies through the darkening hills of Yonkers. Mengel drives up into those hills and eventually parks the patrol car. He still can't shut off the lights, so he knows there's not much time before he's spotted. On Van Buren Avenue, only 3 blocks or so from the traffic stop, where backup would soon converge, finding nothing but rubber marks on the road, Mengel ditches the patrol car. It's kind of a suburban street, but it's not the best area. You know, it's not your typical suburb. He lays Officer Stimulowski, now dead, down across the front seats so his body is not visible to passersby, either on foot or in vehicle. Then Alex Mengel, cop killer, flees the scene. But not before liberating Officer Stimulowski's service weapon, a .38 Smith & Wesson stainless steel revolver, from its holster. Mengel, a gun nut, will no doubt be thrilled to have this in his possession as he scurries into the shadows and makes his escape. It will take an hour for another cop to spot the blue warble of Sam 1's lights flashing up in the hills. No resident bothered calling in or checking on the oddly stationed and seemingly deserted flashing patrol car. After all, who calls the cops on the cops, especially in 1985 in New York, you know? And in these parts, a flashing cop car is something to be avoided. Once Officer Stimulowski is discovered, the chase is on for the blue 1973 Chevy Capri he'd been calling in before going radio silent and meeting his end of watch. The assumption is that there had been a chase and that the killer had stopped on Van Buren up in the hills at a point where he'd been able to get the jump on Stimulowski, then shot him up in those hills before speeding off again in his own vehicle. In reality, Mengel's cohorts drive back to their neighborhood and park the ghostmobile close to their apartment. Mengel is nowhere near the Bronx, but that is where the manhunt for him will naturally head. He escapes into the hills of Yonkers without any pursuit as a result. Alex Mengel finds a deli and enters it at around 8 p.m. The shopkeeper will later remember him for how much he had been sweating, even though it was a chilly February evening. Mengel purchases a Sprite and downs it quickly. He watches nervously as cop cars scream past the deli. In his hand, he clutched something covered in a rag, likely the weapon or weapons he had on him now, the one from Officer Stimulowski and the illegal one that he had shot Stimulowski with. This cop killing, and the way in which it occurred, is the only such case like it at the time and since. It's something out of a movie. Detectives can't be blamed for initially missing the fact that Mengel was in the vicinity of Officer Gary Stimulowski's dumped body and squad car. Never before had a perpetrator shot a cop at a traffic stop, then hopped into his patrol car and drove away with the dead cop or dying cop still in the vehicle, while friends of that homicidal psychopath got the perpetrator's vehicle out of the area and far from the actual location where he would eventually flee the scene. It's an unbelievable situation. Alex Mengel finishes his Sprite in the deli, then heads back out into the night, a night lit up by police sirens and flashing lights. He eventually holes up in a storage shed for the Yonkers Motor Inn, which is a really depraved place, apparently. A lot of druggies, a lot of messed up situations going on there, so he fits in quite well. And he just slips into the storage shed and gets some rest. It's an early night for him, but it's been a long night, compressed into a period of about 2 hours now. Even longer a night it will be for investigators, who are drawn to the Bronx after finding out that Mengel's ghostmobile is registered from there. Remember, Officer Stimulowski had called that vehicle in before being shot, so there's an all-out search for the blue Chevy Capri with the ghosts on it. And it's not hard to find. Those accomplices of Mengel's had parked it in his Bronx neighborhood. The vehicle staked out for a few hours in the hopes of Mengel returning to it. Eventually, this tactic has to be abandoned and the vehicle is impounded. A thorough search of the ghostmobile yields a few concerning finds, one being the disabled passenger side door handle. The other is found hidden up in the dashboard, beyond the ashtray and cigarette lighter. A tourism map of Pennsylvania with Harrisburg circled, and two X's marked in wooded areas. Also, there were five photos of never-to-be-identified teenage girls. One was a Polaroid, and the rest were wallet-sized photos that looked like school pictures. I'll move on from this disturbing dead end in the Ghostmobile, but there was a brief investigation that ended with one investigator in Pennsylvania saying that it's best to, quote, let sleeping dogs lie. In the years leading to Mengele's known criminal story that begins with the execution of Officer Stimulowski, Mengele had been known to disappear on so-called hunting trips to parts unknown. In Harrisburg, the place that's circled on this Pennsylvania tourism map, there had been a mysterious poacher who became so well known by locals that they named him the Woodsman. And this is in the years leading up to 85, 82, 83, 84. And many think that Alex Mengele was this woodsman. Was he? That's a question we'll be asked at least twice more here before our story meets its violent end. Twice more in two separate situations. Was Alex Mengele responsible? Mengele sleeps, something he had no trouble doing despite the situation. He'd often sleep in his car or in an abandoned cabin in the Catskill Mountains. So this Fleabag motel storage shed with its motel-style storage, likely mattresses, pillows, blankets, who knows, was five-star accommodation for the Cretan. Back in the Bronx and half an hour drive south of his position, cops are swarming Mengele's neighborhood. One of the first doors they hit turns out to be where his friends were staying, the Bronx 4 they end up being called. Mengele's cohorts keep their mouths shut, which keeps the monkey wrench of Mengele having not been the one to drive his vehicle home to the Bronx firmly stuck in the gears of the manhunt's direction. They think he's in the Bronx. He's in Yonkers. It's like a 2.5 hour walk away and, like I said, half an hour drive. Eventually, after one interrogator threatens to throw one of the Bronx 4 out of a window, they learn that Alex Mengele had plans to go see a friend in Buffalo. They also learned that Mengele had taken off in Officer Stimulowski's squad car after shooting him point blank in the head with an illegal weapon. That's the least of what he did, but some believe the reason why he shot him was because he had this illegal weapon on him. I believe, as well as do many others, is that he had plenty of skeletons in his closet. He was worried about some of them falling out. Some might find it disturbing that a cop would threaten to throw a person out a window, just to go back here for a second. Throw someone out a window in order to gain much needed information. It was a two-story window. It was hot that day in the interrogation. And this cop grabbed one of the Bronx 4 and threatened to throw him by the window. And that's how they got the information. But I don't find it to be too disturbing. Honestly, I find it to be a little bit uplifting for some reason. There's nothing more satisfying to me than when some cocky, loudmouth criminal scumbag type that believes they can't be touched because a cop might get in trouble gets touched by a billy club or a taser. And I know that's not a popular stance these days. I know. And obviously mistakes get made. Corruption exists. I've seen it myself in very small ways in my small situations. But overall, I like the idea of violence being used by a cop to get a scumbag to talk or shut up. I think cops should be a little scary. It's a scary world out there for a cop. I think they need to meet scary with scary, and maybe at times even scarier. And if you don't like me saying that, call the cops, I guess. And I hope they smack you around a bit for wasting their time. I'm just kidding. I kid. Speaking of kids, hey kid, you want a ride? This is Alex Mengele. In his dreams, I picture dreams of mayhem. And his nightmares are only of capture. 12-year-old Antonella Mattina was kidnapped during a downpour on July 16th of 1984. Not long after Mengele had abused his wife so badly that she was given a new name and address. This is little less than a year before the Officer Stimulowski slaying at Roadside. Mengele's brother Gustav, a sicko himself who would later become a convicted pedophile with a taste for girls of 12, 13 years old and younger, lived just 6 blocks from the Linden View Shopping Center in Flushing, Queens, where at around 11 a.m. of July 16, 1984, Antonella Mattina was stolen, perhaps coaxed into a ghostmobile by a poacher. Whatever happened next, we can't be sure, but we know that eventually Antonella's skull, with braces still attached to the teeth, would be discovered in the woods off of the Taconic State Parkway in New York on Thanksgiving Day of 1987. This stretch of wood-shrouded highway would have been one well-traveled by Mengele on his hunting excursions for animals, his poaching trips. Many believe Alex Mengele to be responsible for the 12-year-old's demise, including famed missing persons detective Anthony Lombardi, who I read would later take his own life due in no small part to the still unsolved Antonella Mattina case. And I can't do that situation there justice, but there is a book you could read and a podcast you need to listen to on this subject once we're finished here. You can find links in the show notes. Unearthing a Serial Killer is an excellent podcast, overlooked entirely for some reason. And there's also a book by the same name, Unearthing a Serial Killer, on the Alex Mengele case. I would have been lost with the work done there. Check it out in the show notes. I have links once we're done here again. So, Mengele maybe dreams of all the children he's stolen while he's in this shed in the Yonkers Motel, outer parking lot. The women he's hunted down and made mystery of float through his mind. But eventually, he must face the nightmare outside of this seedy Yonkers Motel storage shed. This makeshift sleeping bunk he's in is crawling with cops, looking for any excuse to kill him. But by daybreak, they've all gone to the Bronx. And Mengele slinks out from hiding and scurries into the Yonkers woods. He has 2 guns on him. One his own illegal one, one that of Officer Stimulowski that he stole from him. Those guns likely won't be used for any poaching of game in these parts. His rifles and shotgun are lost to him along with the ghostmobile he might have used those. He had wanted to live off of the land at some point of his life, but for now he'd have to make do living off of people. Mengele needs a vehicle, and the beast within him needs a feed. He follows a train track in the woods alongside Yonkers Avenue that makes his way along the Sawmill River. He stays hidden all day, then comes closer to civilization at dusk. Around 7 p.m., he is staking at the parking lot of a locally famous restaurant, the Cantina. He is exhausted, cold, and hungry. The plan is to hijack a vehicle being entered by a lone woman in this parking lot, but the restaurant is bustling with nothing but couples. Mengele moves on to a dimly lit lot about 1.5 miles down the road. This is an IBM satellite office where only a couple of cars sit parked. Mengele hopes that there are women inside working the evening shift. The plan is to poach one as they enter their vehicle to drive home. Could this be your summer of discovery? Yeah, with Rosetta Stone it could be. Whether you're traveling abroad, planning a staycation, or just shaking up your routine, what better time to dive into a new language? With Rosetta Stone, you can turn downtime into meaningful progress. Rosetta Stone is a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. I've been using it to try to learn Japanese, as I mentioned already multiple times. I mean, Rosetta Stone and I are good friends at this point, and I'm surprised how quickly you can pick things up in bite-sized lessons. And what I mean by that is, like, if you're planning on going somewhere or interacting with someone who has another language underneath their belt or a country that is required to speak that language wherever you are in certain situations, you can pick up bite-sized things to get you by. And I really like that about it. And it makes you feel like you are learning when you haven't developed the entire scope of it. At least you have a foot in the door with these bite-sized lessons and learning with their true accent feature. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert. It has 30 years of experience teaching people. I mean, there's millions of users and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more. Rosetta Stone is a go-to tool for real language growth, and you can learn faster, retain longer. The big thing with Rosetta Stone for me is that you get this lifetime membership with them when you sign on, and you just never know when it's going to come in handy. Whatever trip comes up in the future, you can prepare yourself with this in your back pocket. So don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential right now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. This episode is brought to you by IQ Bar, our exclusive snack and hydration sponsor here at Dark Topic. And we're so excited to announce they've teamed up with Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, on two special edition products, a salted caramel chip protein bar and a yuzu mango hydration mix drink. And I've been eating a whole hell of a lot of salted caramel chip protein bars. I don't get sick of them. That's one thing I'll say about those. It's a great treat and decent for you, as well as the yuzu mango hydration mix drink. I mean, I'll have one before bed. I'll have one when I wake up in the morning. Something about it. I mean, really great flavor, and makes me feel like I came back to life after I chug one of those bad boys. IQ Bar's plant protein bars, they're mixed with clean, delicious ingredients that keep you physically and mentally fit. The salted caramel chip IQ Bar that I've just mentioned there, it has 12 grams of protein and only 1 gram of sugar, and it has brain-boosting nutrients in it like lion's mane, adaptogen. The Yuzu Mango IQ mix is a refreshing zero-sugar hydration mix that marries bold flavor and essential electrolytes for your body and lion's mane plus magnesium for your brain. Just mix with water for Michelin star taste and next level hydration. 10% of sales, I should mention, go to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, which supports the next generation of aspiring U.S. chefs. With over 20,000 five-star reviews and counting, more people than ever are fueling their busy lifestyles with IQ bars, brain, clearly I didn't drink my yuzu drink this morning, brain and body boosting bars, hydration mixes, and mushroom coffees. This is the snack that you should start stocking in your cupboards when you go to reach for that, you know, ice cream at night, that chocolate bar during the day. I'd suggest reach for an IQ bar. They sent me the salted caramel chip IQ bar, the yuzu mango mix. And I mean, again, I've been going back and forth on those, and I just can't believe that something so delicious could be so good for me. And right now, IQ Bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% of all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text DARK to 64,000. Text DARK to the number 64,000. That's DARK to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
44-year-old Beverly Capone is getting ready to leave work at around 8 p.m. She is right on time for the starving sadist, shivering in the shadow of the IBM office. Beverly is asked by a coworker if she has any plans this Monday night, to which Beverly responds, quote, "I'm going to take these old bones home." Beverly would have been aware of the cop killing that had occurred the previous evening, not just because it was big news, but because this coworker of hers was the wife of one of the lead investigators on the Officer Stimulowski slaying. It's a tight-knit community. Everybody knows everybody. Well, the good people do. The bad people know each other as well. But the good people really know one another, especially within the cop community, and they kind of hold tight. And Beverly Capone is kind of a part of it through having friends involved in law enforcement. Beverly is soon approaching her brand new white 1985 Toyota Tercel through the small dark lot. Mengele has chosen her vehicle already as the one he wants, and when Mrs. Capone walks up to it, he knows it's meant to be. Beverly is his type, except a little older than he'd prefer. Still, she's pretty, petite, dark-haired, dark-eyed, Irish-Italian. As she opens the driver's side door, Mengele accosts her from behind and forces the frightened woman into the passenger's seat. Mengele, as I mentioned, had chosen this vehicle. He's taken the time already to have broken in and disabled the passenger door so there could be no escape from it, much like he'd done with his own Ghostmobile. It's this kind of quick planning and zero hesitancy to follow through on a nefarious inkling that hints to Mengele being a journeyman poacher of people. He has contacts in Buffalo and Toronto, Canada, that he wants to make his way to. The plan is to flee the country. The way in which he'll achieve disguise to do so is part of the reason Mengele is so heavily linked to the Silence of the Lambs film, book, story. Again, we don't know much, but we know this. Mengele drives Beverly Capone out to the Catskill Mountains, breaks into a cottage where he does God knows what to her, before stabbing Beverly twice in the heart. Incredibly, Beverly's own mother had been a murder victim, also as a result of stabbing. But that's where the terrible parallels end, as Beverly's killer goes so much further. Mengele begins the gruesome work of degloving her face, that is, cutting her face off. The plan is to use the face as a way to disguise himself and use Beverly Capone's photo identification as a way to get across the border to Canada. Oh, and he also scalps the woman. Then he wraps her in a shower curtain and then takes her out to the woods where he finds an old stone wall, maybe used during the Civil War. Mengele works to remove enough stones so that he can shove the body into the wall, then covers the body up. Beverly Capone will be discovered later by cadaver dogs. Her condition will become the stuff of Hannibal Lecter's M.O. The face doesn't fit, but the scalp looks pretty good apparently. Mengele puts on makeup and distorts his victim's ID, that's her driver's license, a little to help his chances as passing for Beverly Capone. Mengele is unaware that before her death, Beverly had managed to hide her IBM work ID card in a drawer of that cabin, that cottage, where she was likely raped and murdered. Definitely murdered. This would later help investigators in finding her body. Obviously, Beverly Capone was quite bright. She was also a fighter. Later, a yellow wallet with a picture of her daughter was found on Mengele. Beverly's daughter herself feels that her mother was likely threatened with harm coming to her family if she didn't go along with his wishes. It's hard to know about what became of Beverly Capone's body, but whatever Mengele put her through beforehand was no doubt worse, as she was alive. I should add that she was, beyond being wrapped in the shower curtain, found in a housecoat naked beneath that, which says to me that Mengele probably played house for a bit in that cabin, doing what he would to Beverly Capone before finally killing her and mutilating her corpse in such a horrific way. It is a travesty, and those friends of Mengele who failed to share that he was on the loose up in Yonkers and not somewhere closer to the Bronx could have changed so much here. They protected a likely child killer, a confirmed cop killer, by his ex-wife's account, an insatiable sex fiend who pressured her for sex and beat her up after her giving birth to their child. That's a small detail that I picked up. But this all gives us some insight as to why he needed to grab girls at any given opportunity. He was an insatiable sex fiend and a sadistic killer. It gives us an idea to this point that's only an assumption or a story, actually. How about we'll confirm it now? Mengele drives Beverly's vehicle out to Buffalo State University, where he plans on meeting up with a friend, get some money probably, take a quick breather before going for the border. Soon investigators will have all of the information from the Bronx Four, Mengele's associates, friends, you know, just people he was hanging around with, taking them out hunting in the Catskills. They'll have that information from them and from others about where he'll be headed. So time is of the essence here. I may have made the mistake of making Mengele seem like a mastermind, but really he isn't entirely. Mengele is taking his time, though there will be an APB out for the vehicle he's in at any moment. Surely he must recognize that every cop in New York has a picture of him on their dashboard. That's what the grizzly disguise is about, I guess. With the scalp and the face. But come on, man. You ever heard of a wig? They don't procure those from the scalps of women. You know, they make them ethically, I think, in some places. You can just go buy a wig. I mean, there's some questionable activities in India and China, wherever we get most of these wigs, I believe. But I digress. It's not as questionable as actually scalping a woman. Despite the pressure to get out of New York, Mengel stops in the small village of Skinny Atlas, Syracuse, to make a quick kidnapping attempt. It is mid-morning of February 27th, 1985, when a 13-year-old paper delivery girl hears a strangely accented and oddly feminine voice calling up behind her. This only a couple of days after Officer Stimulewski's murder. When the paper girl turns around, she sees an incredibly ugly woman holding up a map to hide her face somewhat. The lady with the ill-fitting black wig in the white Toyota Tercel wants directions. The 13-year-old is eager to help this paper girl, and she approaches the white car. Mengel gets out and points a gun in her face. The girl can see now that this is a man dressed as a woman, which at the time, 1985, was a shocking sight. Almost more shocking than a gun being pointed at you. Mengel drops the fake female voice and barks at the girl, quote,
"Get in the car or I'll kill you."
Luckily, there's a house behind the girl that she's familiar with, and she takes off running, calling out for help that soon appears. And when that girl points out to where the danger had been, there's nothing but a hideously lipsticked, foundationed, eyeshadowed face floating in the air. That's how quickly Mengel had escaped. There's dust kicked up around this face that's starting to fall away. His makeup flew off and floated there like the face in the magic mirror. What was that? That was Snow White. And maybe I'm stretching a little here. This stuff, you know, sometimes you can just make up. And most of it you can't, but I just did make that up. I made up that floating makeup part there, just to be clear. All right, you guys have been great so far. I think I'll be right back in a minute with a message or two here first, unless I already did the ads, but I need to take a break from this. I'm getting a little bit silly. My apologies. And a train's coming. All right, so we're back. Alex Mengel is driving a stolen car with New York plates across the U.S.-Canadian border, probably at Niagara Falls, and he's got his eyebrows tweezed. They don't look great, but he's trying, you know. Alex, he'd finished his visit with a 19-year-old friend back in Buffalo, a young man who gave him sneakers and money to help him out. I guess Mengel's worn out his own shoes with all this running around he's doing. The friend of Mengel's, this 19-year-old, to a 30-year-old man, tells his classmates that Mengel killed a cop in Yonkers, because Mengel shared that with them, and he tells his classmates that he helped Mengel out, which isn't smart. Investigators are quickly in Buffalo and closing in on Mengel. They learn of the vehicle he's driving and connect it to the Beverly Capone disappearance they thought might be connected already, but they can now confirm it because this friend of Mengel says, yeah, he's driving a white Toyota Tercel. They know that he's the killer, or the kidnapper, is what they know at this point of Beverly Capone. Things are moving quickly. But just a step too slow as Mengel sashays through the Canadian border before New York can alert officials there. Pretty amazing that a guy wearing a woman's scalp and smeared makeup made it through on a doctored ID in a stolen car, but hey, it's 1985, and Canada has always loved a queen. You drop this queen, you know, you drop this king, here's your crown. You drop this queen. Oh, my scalp. Thank you. You know, Mengel makes his way to Scarborough, home of Paul Bernardo, a young Paul Bernardo, future home of the Ken and Barbie killers. He's cruising a section known as the Golden Mile in Scarborough, which is named as such after a spot in England. Almost everything is mirrored after England in that area. I grew up in that area, my hometown of Whitby, Ontario. is named after a place called Whitby over there as well. You know, but I told you, I wasn't kidding. We love a queen over here. It's not long after Alex Mengel's arrival in Canada that the Bolo, the Be on the Lookout, comes through for Toronto Police. And a hero emerges. Officer Clive Richards of the Toronto Police Department, on March 2nd of 1985, less than a week since the killing of Officer Stimoleski in Yonkers, New York, Officer Clive Richards spots the white Toyota Tercel with New York plates on a snowy stretch of the Golden Mile in Scarborough. Officer Clive Richards initiates a chase, and Mengel soon crashes into a snowbank. He gets out of the Toyota, leaving behind the scalp, but bringing with him Officer Stimoleski's service weapon. Mengel drops the weapon as he pulls it from his waistband and immediately shoots his hands to the sky. Officer Richards is all over him, and he's kind of lucky that Mengel has a healthy fear of authority at this point, considering what he's done, knowing he easily could be shot by a cop, and that cop would have no fear in shooting him because the retribution here is completely justified in 1985. He's brought into custody, and it's said he appears to be terrified, maybe because his makeup's running. There's hope for a moment for Mengel that the Canadians will process him, and a transfer to the U.S. will take a while as a result. But when the Canadians realize that there's a human scalp in the car, along with what looks like a degloved face, they quickly give him back to New York. No thanks. That's not a yes, Queen. That's a no, Queen. All right, and that's the last one. He even drove on Queen Street at one point, so that was tough to lay off of that part. But, you know, I think my work with the Queen shit is done here, and my work with screwing around with this story is done here. Mengel's work, however, was not quite done. Somehow. On the drive back to Westchester County from the Canadian border, the detectives with Mengel in the back seat, there's two detectives, one in the front, one in the back with Mengel, they are traversing eventually the Taconic State Parkway through a place named Fishkill in an area not too far from where 12-year-old Antonella waits to be discovered in the woods off of this same road. Alex Mengel, cuffed in the back seat of an unmarked sedan, a Chevy, and being escorted by an officer in the back with him, as well as one driving, of course, like I mentioned, Mengel smashes into a Detective Grunwald in the back there with his head, headbutts him, dazing the detective. Mengel has been cuffed with his hands in front of him, as it's unlawful to be cuffed from behind for such a long driving transfer. Up front, a one Detective Bob Stable works to pull over. As he sees in the rear view, Mengel crushing his partner against the door, pushing with his feet on his own door, gaining massive leverage, Mengel is biting Detective Grunwald, which is a scene in The Silence of the Lambs, you know, biting at the face, biting at the neck. He's biting him in the arm and the shoulder, gnashing now, again for the face and the neck. He's likely hoping to rip at the jugular. Mengel gets a hold of Detective Grunwald's service weapon back there, and he's about to yank it free. Grunwald's holding his thumb or his finger into the trigger piece there to keep him from shooting. Mengel's mouth is coated with this detective's blood as he shouts out, "I'm going to kill you both." A look of rage mixed with exultation on his insane face, still bearing residue of makeup, eyeliner, the blood-like lipstick, those plucked eyebrows now devilish. That's in the rear view. That the upfront detective there, Stable, not feeling so stable in their situation right now, he's looking back at this. And he makes a decision very quickly. He pulls from his pant leg, from his sock, from his holster on his ankle, his weapon. A shot rings out. Mengel drops dead. And just like that, Officer Stable's snub nose, 357 Smith & Wesson, ends this thing. Everything we could ever know about the true breadth of Alex Mengel's criminal career, gone in a puff of smoke that swirls from the hole in his forehead. And do it. You know, some people think that Alex Mengel was assassinated. That because of him being a cop killer, that there was a hit pulled on him along that highway, and that's how he actually died. But there was a witness who was behind the car who saw it all happen. And also, they didn't want him dead. They wanted him to face the music, the New York PD, I mean. They wanted him to face trial. They wanted to find out what more he may have been guilty of. The Detective Lombardi that I mentioned earlier, who was instrumental in the Eaton Patz case, which is a very famous crime in New York, child murder that got solved, I think it was in 2015. I covered it with Deadbug. He was the one on this case, and he wanted a shot at him as well. They wouldn't have assassinated him there. This actually happened. He pulled a Hannibal Lecter and tried to kill both those cops, and he almost got away with it. He was almost able to do it. There were surely more victims. Antonella, you need to know more about. You need to check out Unearthing a Serial Killer. I intentionally left out quite a few details in the wider scope of this case because I was starting to feel like a bit of a poacher myself. I got a lot of the details in this case from Unearthing a Serial Killer. It's a book. It's also a podcast. And you could find that in the show notes. It might not be as entertaining as Dark Topic, but I guarantee you it's a lot more informative. Hey, I hope you're all well. Big love. Eyes cocked, doors locked, stay paranoid. I'll be back as soon as I can be. If you want more, come on over to Dark Topic on Patreon. Click on that thing on Apple Plus for the Plus episodes of Dark Topic Plus. You get a little bit more Dark Topic. You get Deadbug. You get Kent, Chungus, him and I doing Brutal. And sometimes me and my brother and I, doing our thing with the Luna Bin. What else do I got? Marooned. Check out Marooned. We're consistent every couple of weeks. Aaron of Generation Y and I tackle a case of somebody becoming catastrophically lost. Did I already say it? I'll say it again. Until next time, keep those eyes cocked, those doors locked, and stay paranoid. Thank you. Talking to you soon. As soon as I can.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.